I want to thank Michael and Anne McKeever and River Styx. They've been in business for almost 20 years and have done just a remarkable job bringing poets in from all over the place. The name of my book is Promesa. Can you hear me? Thank you. That's my husband. The name of my book is Promesas, Geography of the Impossible. And promesas in Spanish means promises. Geography of the Impossible refers to the impossibility of finding utopia. When the conquistadores, or the voyages of discovery, set out, they were looking for the lands of cocaine, which was sort of an alimentary and sensual paradise, where you could do things and enjoy life and not feel guilty, because it was very restrictive in the Europe of that day, where there was a tremendous guilt culture. So they set out looking for paradise, and when they arrived in Puerto Rico, they thought they had found Eden. And Puerto Rico literally means rich port. And there was gold, and it was lush, tropical, beautiful, wonderful flowers. And then they all these marvelous naked Indians running around and having a perfectly wonderful time and not feeling guilty. So they said, ah, this is it. And they immediately set out to destroy it, because that's what you do. But Eden was always described as out there in a distance somewhere else, in a lost isle at the heart of an ocean, and always unattainable. As Alice in Wonderland wonderfully put it, jam yesterday, jam tomorrow, but never jam today. The first poem I'm going to read is called The Legend of the Flamboyant, and it's in here somewhere, and has to do with the Taino natives. When the Spanish arrived in Puerto Rico, there were, in 1493, my first American ancestor among them. Of course, he was one of the good guys. But there were 60,000 to 70,000 natives. By the year 1530, there were 1,170. The ones who were not decimated by the Spanish committed mass suicide. And the legend of the flamboyant, which is a beautiful crimson flower, and when the leaves, when the petals fall, it lines the country roads so that it's like a red carpet all throughout Puerto Rico. The legend is that the flower took its color from the blood of the Taínos. This is Legend of the Flamboyant. It's in three parts. It was a good, old-fashioned victory. No massacres, no fires, no children gunned down in the streets of day. No cameras to point a finger and say, he did it, or they. It was calm, it was civilized. They emerged from the ocean and claimed their paradise. From the rainforest, naked and trembling beneath chafleras and figs, perched like purple gallinules among the low branches of the jacarandas, the Taínos watched the ironclad strangers wade awkwardly ashore, their banners staking out their land. Chief Aguaybana also watched, the gold guanine glinting on his chest like a target. Who were these intruders, and what were they doing on this island? Could they be cannibals like the Caribes? Could they be gods? Their bodies glistened like stars, their eyes like the sea. The Taínos met and argued well into the night, weighing the pros and cons of strategy. If these were gods, to ignore them might incite their wrath. To fight them might invite death. Best to rejoice then and welcome the silver giants to Borinquen. The Spaniards responded by taking first their freedom, then their land, then using them as human picks to dig for gold. Gold for the crown, gold for the holy faith, gold for the glory of Spain. Two. The darkness of the mines consumed them, sapped their laughter, their song, locking them into perpetual night. The women drew in, their hearts hard against the longing they saw in the stranger's eyes. Not to look, not to be seen. They bowed their heads, folded into themselves like secrets, whispered only in the safety of brown arms. Three. A wrecked vessel washed ashore at Oaxaca. The children race down to the beach looking for treasures, looking under torn sails, beneath coiled ropes, turning over loosened boards, and suddenly, a hand, then a face, the skin pale and mottled, the eyes staring up at them, opaque, like a fish, the color of the sea. Something dead, something ungodly. The island echoed their cries. That night, the Tainos planned carefully, knowing, like those at Massava before them, that there was no other way. They drew straws. The first Spaniard to awaken was startled by the hush, as though the earth itself had given up. He stepped out into the chill, into the stained silence, but saw only flowers, thousands of flamboyants, splashes of blood blooming all over the island. Now, we now jump to the 20th century. And I'm going to read a poem called Fire, which is about my grandmother. After the Spanish-American War, my great-grandfather pulled down, or whatever you do with flags, the Puerto Rican flag, so that the Americans could put up the American flag, and with tears in his eyes. And my grandmother told me the story quite often. After the Depression, or during the Depression, she wound up, it's a very long story, but she wound up in New York City. The family had been forced to sell their lands in Vieques to make way for a naval air force base, or a naval base, and they still have one. It's one of the largest in the country. And she was a very dignified woman, very tall, very stately, big, Germanic. Her father's name was Riekehoff. And she found herself in a less than dignified environment. And this poem is about her and explores the Puerto Rican experience in New York City and the disparity between promises and reality. Fire. The fire broke out in 1B, the garden apartment where the Irish family lived. The rest of us, the Puerto Ricans, relegated to inland brown rooms that blotted out the memory of hope, the cornflower blue of skies over Luquillo, the crimson country roads painted with petals from flamboyants, the fuchsia hands of oleander waving for us to come back, come back, come back to the healing seas of East La Nena, the beaches rich with gold. It was an upstairs hell, this darkness, this gloom, this view of brick and cement and dried pigeon dung. An ugly green stairwell gnawed its way up through the center of this urban silo, its bare bulbs flickering a neon stain on the drained faces of tenants stopping to rest on every landing, to catch their breath, to lean for a moment or two on the handrail, wondering where exactly they had made a wrong turn, a wrong choice, knowing, despite rumors they were transient, that there was no turning back, that the only paths left to them led to other stairwells in other tenements, to other windows facing other brick walls. When the fire broke out that morning, Abuelita, which means little grandmother, was making the beds, a ritual she enjoyed and I enjoyed watching. The perfect corner she could control, the coverlet she could smooth with a slow sweep of her hand, urging all creases to disperse. A gesture I would remember today, sitting at a ballpark 50 years and 1,500 miles away, watching boys in royal blue chase air pockets trapped beneath the stadium tarp out into the chill night. An escape Abuelita would never know, but always long for. Like indulgences during the Middle Ages, rents in New York City are scaled according to height. The nearer to God the apartment, the higher the rent. And nearest to God were we on the sixth floor of that east side tenement when fire, like pride incensed, found voice and screamed through the inarticulate darkness of the dumbwaiter, cursing the heavens, the forgotten covenant, the silence. Sirens and bullhorns ordered us to evacuate. A neighbor's son banged on our front door yelling, "Fuego, fuego!" before racing down the steps 10 at a time, the thump of his sneakers growing fainter and fainter. Abuelita sighed and stopped making the bed. She instructed me to wash my face and hands. Sitting at her vanity, she studied the sorrow etched around her mouth. She smiled, applied a circle of rouge to each raised cheek, and a sliver of pomade to her lips. Then she shut her eyes and patted her face with a pink velvet puff. Particles of powder spiraled in the lamplight like flurries of snow. I was enthralled. She brushed her hair back into a bun and fastened it with long silver hairpins. Finally, she stood, looked at her tall, ample figure in the full-length mirror, and shook her head. Moments later, she emerged from the bedroom in a different black print dress, a brooch of silver and onyx pinned to its lapel. She put on a black straw hat, lowered the veil over her eyes, took her purse and gloves in one hand, my still damp hand in the other, and led me out the door. We descended in slow motion zigzags toward daylight and life and lies we would come to accept as truths. By the time we reached the third floor landing, we were greeting neighbors returning from a moment's safety to a higher, more insidious level of salvation. The fire was contained, but my grandmother and I were ready as we would ever be. A lot of these poems are about my family, but in truth, I remember very little. Most of my memories are passed down from, well, their stories or photographs. You look at photographs and you say, ah, yes, I remember that. But you don't really. My mother was in show business and would flit in and out of my life and stroke me and bring me lots of presents and then disappear again. And I wrote this poem about her. Well, sort of about her. It's a poem about how I felt growing up. And I sent it to her, and she said, oh, it's entirely too short. If that's about me, it should be much longer. Then I cut out the last line, and when she got the book, she called me immediately. She said, I read my poem, and you cut it. So those of you who write, beware. This is called My Mother, Cunning Yet Innocent. And after I finish reading it, I'll tell you the last line. My mother, cunning yet innocent, grabbing the new moon by its promise and whistling through the suave sky for an easy escape to where stardom should have been but seldom was. My mother split like a seasoned log, ready for burning, yet whole and immutable as bronze, her slender arms unbendable, her teeth clenched behind an ardent Rita Hayworth smile. Still ill-defined, she slips away, gathering herself up into the thinnest sliver of equivocation, falling between folds of supple logic until she's almost out of earshot. But I'm obsessed with the mystery, shout after her, wait, wait. The air is heavy with gardenias and sweet tobacco. Smoke rings from her lips drift out of sight like elliptic vows, while I strain to capture them on my tiny wrists and fingers, not knowing then, no, not yet knowing. And the last line was, trusting her to be mine forever. Now, this is one about my father, because, you know, we have to have equal time. I didn't know my father. My father and my mother were divorced when I was a wee little thing. And, I'm not going to read that. Sorry. I'm going to read a poem about my grandfather. And it's called Malcriada. Now, malcriada in Spanish means spoiled. But it also means badly raised or badly reared, which is more, it's more about the person doing the rearing than the person being reared. And it's a very common expression. Everyone is malcriada. There's a, the first line is in Spanish, and it's, te voy a dar una paliza, muchacha, which means I'm going to give you a licking, child. But paliza was usually done with a little stick. But since we lived in New York City and the nearest tree was in Central Park many miles away, I was spared that. My grandfather actually was a very sweet man. This is malcriada. Te voy a dar una paliza, muchacha, my grandfather threatens as he pulls the strap from his belt loops and in one fell swoop snaps it against the seat of a chair with a resonating then holding his pants up with his free hand, he waves the strap in the air like a lasso and gives the chair two more swift slaps to satisfy my grandmother in the other room and silence my giggles. His cheeks turn as red as a clown's. His blonde curls tremble like cooked fusilli. His eyes narrow down to two tiny slits of sky, while I, convinced he is putting on a show for me, fall to the floor convulsed with laughter. Muchacha, he pleads, unable to keep a straight face. Then shaking his head, he sighs, ay, bendito, digs into his vest pocket and gives me two new pennies for an Eskimo pie. Ay bendito is a typical Puerto Rican phrase, and it's said of anything that elicits pity or sympathy, and you have to roll your eyes, you have to go, ay bendito. And I don't know any other country, any other Latino country or that uses that. Okay. I have these in order. This is Latchkey Kid. It's a poem about all those children who grow up and come home to an empty house, in this case, an empty apartment. Instead of butterscotch caramels glistening in a baccarat jar, her house is dark, bitter chocolate. So dark, shadows cringe in the corners. Clouds surround it low and hoarse like a bad head cold in December. At night, insistent drafts lick the threshold, stretching their rough tongues across the hearth. Her bones ache, feel like popsicle sticks, stained lime, sucked dry. She never wants to go home. It smells of death. She goes instead to a friend's house after school. Outstays her welcome through Frito-Lays, pork chops, awkward conversation, as parents' eyes exchange impatience. She lies she will be going in a while, but she's afraid and cannot tell them her house is dark, dark like her mother's blood, dark like the crimson rose her father sent her for her 7th birthday, a rose with a smudged note he did not write. She keeps its tall, brittle stem in a bottle beside her bed. When she turns on the light, it casts a shadow across her life. This is a poem I wrote about Colcante Hondo, which is about the death of García Lorca. And I really didn't know anything about the death of García Lorca. And I just wrote, I made up this poem. And then I read the book, his biography, and it isn't too far off. And it was sort of strange. I have a juxtaposition of Segovia, who represents the cool, intellectual, Apollonian approach to art, and Lorca, the Dionysian, which is more passionate. He believed in el duende. He said el duende would rise from the ground up through las plantas de los pies, through the soles of the feet and into the body, and out would come something creative. So this is Cante Hondo. Segovia says Lorca was killed by a jealous lover. But I know that isn't so. I know he was seized from midnight reverie, pride screaming from the poem in his head, the lover beside him pleading with Franco's men before the butt end of a German carbine careened him into a wordless sleep, taking him worlds away from Lorca, Guernica, and the caves of Andalusia, from the fifth column, the Falange, death, far, far from death, deep into a dream sweetened by seas, seeping slowly into Moroccan fields, where boys, culipandiando, ignite the light-eyed lust of tourists who come down to excavate their scraggy yield, Arabs preferring the ripe, moist meat of melons. And Lorca's lover lying in that crazy, hard-on dream, oblivious of what was going on, unconscious of his own demise, with the poet gone, who would immortalize his soul? And the barrel of a rifle prodding Lorca's chest like the insistent finger of Uncle Sam, hard up against his anus, prying open his mouth, muévelo, maricón, and Lorca's face green as the craters of his vellum moon, his body twisted, a hibiscus against the dawn, stumbles as they jab him on, blindfold filth across his eyes, those eyes, bind laces from his shoes into his wrists, so when he staggers to the wall, his shoes drag through the gravel, unraveling the earth's tears, the earth's dark song. Drige, 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 domine Deus meus in conspecto tuo. Lorca, my poet, shot down in prayer, while his lover unaware sleeps and dreams of almond eyes and bougainvillea. Homosexuals die violent deaths, Segovia says, playing a Bach fugue on his guitar. Now you have to tell me when I have 5 minutes left. Please. This poem is about my father's funeral, and this is not based on fantasy or half memories. This actually did happen. And it was very interesting. I read this at Florida International University, and a woman stood up in the middle of the audience, and I had introduced my father as being an independentist. And this is very appropriate today because they just voted for the continuation of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and not for statehood or independence. But my father was an independentista and really seriously believed in the independence of Puerto Rico and spent all of his life working toward that. And at his funeral became a sort of a political rally. But while I was introducing the poem at Florida International University, and a woman stood up in the audience and she said, pero tú eres la hija de Erasmo Bando, are you Erasmo Bando's daughter? And I said, yes, and she came running up to the front and threw her arms around me. I didn't know if she was going to kill me or, you know, whatever. But she didn't, and she hugged me, and she said, I loved your father, and then started telling me about the avocado plant in his backyard and all these things that I really didn't know because I didn't know my father that well. So she obviously knew him better than I did. But then she said something that was fascinating. She said two lines from the poem I was about to read, and she said in English, your father was a great man, a great man. And I got goosebumps. Anyway, this is at my father's funeral. My father, a free thinker, who insisted I be reared like him, lies in his open casket, the blood of Jesus dripping on his clean white shirt. El grito de Lares, that's pinned to one lapel, la bandera to the other, and instead of boleros or plenas permeating the heavy incense of the chapel, a rosario of Padre Nuestros and Ave Marias churns the air. I study his hands, try to stroke away the spots that will bury themselves into my skin like spiders, brown recluses that will never let go. Be careful, his doctor warns me. Your father died of skin cancer. But at 93, I'd say he's entitled to go as he pleases. And this ceremony that accompanies his departure is not my doing. I have no rights here. My half-sister removes the pins from my father's lapels and presses them into my hand like omens. You're the firstborn, she says. We decided you should have them. I pin them on my blouse. At the cemetery, a handsome woman with white hair stands on the sidelines, flanked by men in gray suits. Lolita Lebrón, Lolita Lebrón, my sister whispers. And it is 1954, I am in Holland, studying literature and art, when the news comes over the wires, and students at school start asking me whether I'm ashamed of being Puerto Rican. And I, in turn, ask them whether they feel shame for Hiroshima, or Dresden, or Dachau, because I do. And they can't understand that it all has to do with me, with them. And here's Lolita Lebrón, patriot or terrorist, take your pick. Though she never fired a shot. I didn't come to kill, I came to die, she proclaimed, ready to give her life for el gran ideal, the great ideal. Her sole aim to publicize the plight of her besieged island. They stormed the spectators' gallery, she and three men, waving German Lugers and their outlawed flag and shouting, freedom for Puerto Rico. When one of the men went berserk and began shooting into the crowded floor of the house, congressmen diving for cover, under desks, behind chairs, five hit, bleeding, visitors screaming for help. It was a suicide mission. Born in Lares, she felt it was her destiny. But how could she have known the sacrifice would be her children? Her son murdered during the trial, the daughter killed in an accident, or so they said, and she in and out of solitary confinement for 35 years, unable to eat or sleep, unable to breathe, her hair turning white overnight, like her heart a dead weight. The roster at the gravesite reads like a who's who of better days. The leaders, old and infirm, come on crutches and canes, but they come. My other sister tapes their tributes. They recite my father's poems, sing songs I didn't know he wrote. When they sing La Borinqueña, that's the anthem, the one song I do know, my words are all wrong. This is a new version, Lolita's version, and my anthem, my sweet anthem, is no longer a danza, but a marching song. Your father was a great man, they all tell me, a great man. I look cautiously around me and spot them, one, two, maybe three dark-suited men in the distance, blending into the trees, documenting our sorrow with hidden cameras and tape recorders. No one pays attention to them. The FBI is as much a part of their lives as the shadows their bodies cast across my father's grave. I want to cry out that I am innocent, that I have nothing to do with violence, nothing to do with them. I'm there because we share a name, a face. But when I look at my sisters, I see my fate. The next morning, my half-brother waits at the airport. He sees Papi's slogans like stigmata bleeding on my lapels. Ten cuidado, he warns me. They might not let you out. We embrace, and I see our shadows on the sidewalk merge. When I kiss him, it is as if I were kissing myself goodbye. The next poem I'm going to read is called Psychomachia. These are heavy poems, but I had a heavy life. Psychomachia is about the death of my grandmother, and in a sense, Beckett said that he could not have gotten through the wretchedness of life without leaving a stain upon the silence. And I felt that way and wrote this to my grandmother because she had nothing really left when she died. When I die, she will die with me. And maybe now she won't. She'll stay around a little longer. It's called Psychomachia, which is the contest of the good and evil forces for the departing soul. And if the devils win, the soul goes to hell. And if the angels win, it goes up to heaven. And I actually witnessed this with my grandmother. This is the poem. Oh, the other thing is that Puerto Ricans are very much, they're on first-name basis with their organs, their internal organs. You never have a pain in the side. You have a pain in the upper left quadrant of the spleen. You know, they're on very good terms, and it's important to say that. This is for Lucila Riquejoff Medina, 1880 to 1967. Old woman, you took so long in dying, proclaiming every year to be your last, citing death, describing its approach through liver, spleen, and heart. Old woman, you took so long in dying, they forgot you were alive. Not I. I watched your body wither slowly, secretly, your bones cringing from the lies they've forced into your veins. I saw your brain frantic in that half-light of infirmity, spawn demons whose scorching tongues and taunting wings fanned your despair. I would come to cut your hair, your nails, bathe your brittle shoulders with bay rum, stilling the stale scent of death with sweet perfume, fleeting memories of palms and seas and youth. And you let go. Ever so slowly, you let go, easing an arthritic grip on sanity, your devil's full-grown, lascivious, obscene. And I, hipócrita, you screamed, because I said I could not see them. How could I rid you of your incubus, or hear the vanquished demons rage and cry, confusi sumus, if I could not see them? I mourn you, old woman, though I love you more in memory than in fact. You had become a stranger to me, distant, brooding. I had to learn to look beyond your mood, my mind screening out the present as yours the past. Perhaps we were meant to meet on that unlabeled plane, I to cradle you, you to teach me pain. What? Oh, okay. Thank you. About 2 years ago, astronomers discovered a crab nebula in the southern sky, and they described it as a process by which two stars engage. The two stars were then described as a cold pulsating red giant and a small hot companion. So much for the Big Bang, right? And there are lots of dust, and one star would throw rings around the other star. And I don't know, I just sort of put two and two together. The whole thing struck me so funny that I wrote this poem. And the name of the star is, the name of the nebula is HE2104. HE2104. A true planetary nebula in the making. On the universal clock, Sagan tells us, we are only moments old. And this new crab-like discovery in Centaurus, though older by far, is but an adolescent going through a vital, if brief, stage in the evolution of interacting stars. I see it starting its sidereal trek through midlife, glowingly complex, a pulsating red giant with a small hot companion in tow. And think of you and me that night in August, speeding across Texas in your red Mustang convertible, enveloped in dust and fumes, aiming for a motel bed, settling instead for the back seat of the car, arms and legs flailing in all directions, but mostly toward heaven. And now, this cool red dude winking at me through the centuries as if to say, I know, I know. Sidling in closer to his sidekick, shedding his garments, shaking off dust, encircling her small girth with a high-density lasso of himself, high-velocity sparks shooting from her ringed body like crazy legs and arms until at last he's got his hot companion in a classic hold. And slowly, in ecstasy, they take wing and blaze as one across the southern skies. No longer crab, but butterfly. And that's what happens. It changes form. It goes from the crab form to the butterfly form. And I'm going to close with a poem in Spanish, which no one will understand, but that's all right. Because it's a poem of rhythm. And Spanish is a rhythmic language. This poem is called Borinquen, and it's sort of a lament, in a sense, a longing to be in Puerto Rico. Borinquen. Estoy sumamente lejos de ti, lejos del tiki-tiki de las maracas que se reían con tus llamadas en días de fruto, en horas de canto. Lejos del tum-tucutum de tu corazón y acompañaba el tiki-tiki de las maracas que se burlaban de tus llamadas en días de luto, en horas de espanto. Y tú, encerrado en el timbre del coquí, en el llanto de palmas, en el son, son, son de tu isla perdida, llamando a tu encanto, llamando a tu vida, con el tiki-tiki de las maracas y el tum-tucutum de tu corazón, llamando, llamando, llamando. Thank you.